Good afternoon, Tri-States! You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. This is Ken, reading from the Thursday, November 19, 2020, Dubuque Telegraph Herald. Know that we are brought to you in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. And our first piece from above the fold. We have a small inset picture of a parking lot with a few cars parked in it and what appears to be a manufacturing building. And the article is ProPulse Plans Expansion from Piasta. A Piasta manufacturer is investing about $2 million in an expansion that will allow the company to grow both its footprint and its workforce. ProPulse recently broke ground on a 20,000-square-foot addition to its facility on Cap Drive. President Jeff Thies said the project should be completed in the first quarter of 2021. The additional space will allow ProPulse to hire 10 to 20 more employees in the next 18 months. ProPulse specializes in the manufacturing of high-pressure hoses that are used in pressure washers, agricultural machinery, and a variety of other products. While 2020 ushered in massive economic changes, some of them worked to the company's advantage. One of the phenomena in 2020 we didn't expect was growth in the consumer products sector of our business, Thies said. The CARES Act put disposable income in a lot of consumers' pockets, and they had a tendency to spend that on a lot of consumer goods. We were able to participate in that in 2020. The additional square footage will provide space for new equipment and machinery, engineering and development workspaces, and larger common areas for employees. The history of ProPulse dates back to the 1990s, when it initially opened under the umbrella of German-based Schiefer Company. The operation in Piasta began with just 6 employees working out of a 12,000-square-foot facility. Today, the company occupies 3 facilities in Piasta and employs 115 people. Dan McDonald, vice president of existing business for Greater Dubuque Development Corporation, indicated that the latest expansion at ProPulse seems like a natural extension of the success the company has shown throughout its tenure. They have been dogged and steady with their growth over the years, he said. It hasn't been a rocket ride to the moon. Instead, it has been very consistent and deliberate in terms of how they execute on their business model and plan to expand. The latest expansion is particularly impressive to McDonald, given the backdrop against which it is taking place. He noted that COVID-19 has disrupted businesses across the globe, and figuring out a path forward has proven difficult for many companies. Businesses today are playing a game of three-dimensional chess around the world, trying to meet and exceed customer demand and balance the health, safety, and wellness of their employees, he said. The fact that they have the confidence to invest and expand during a year like this is very impressive. Thies acknowledged that landing new workers won't be an easy task. Despite a rise in unemployment, he emphasized that the labor market remains tight, and in the eyes of many employers, it is even tighter than it was before COVID-19. Even so, he is confident the company's track record of attracting talent will hold true in the year ahead. We seem to be able to attract the type of employees that we need, he said. Thies said the company's ability to successfully weather the economic storm of 2020 bodes well for the years ahead. The fact that we got through 2020 with a strong increase in demand for products, that means we are going into the next couple of years with a great deal of optimism, he said. As we emerge from the fog of COVID, we think there will be some pent-up customer demand, and we feel good about 2021 and 2022. Our next piece Local students learn philanthropy firsthand through school foundations. Madison Lewis and her classmates have $4,000 to spend this year to support their peers at Hempstead High School in Dubuque. What that money funds, however, is up to them. For me, it's kind of weird having that much authority being a junior, Madison said. It's a little bit different, but I really like it because it's student deciding where the money goes. She is a member of her school's new Student Support Foundation, through which students have the opportunity to award grants to meet needs on their campuses. A similar organization also is starting this fall at Dubuque Senior High School. Through the foundations, students get to see the difference giving back can make, with an aim at helping them learn to invest in their communities as they get older. I think it can do great work within our schools and for our students as well, and help them learn how to be philanthropic back in their own communities as they become young adults, said Amy Unmacht, Executive Director of Foundation for Dubuque Public Schools. Funding for the school groups comes from the Colorado-based Morridge Family Foundation, which supplies each campus with $4,000 per year for students to distribute. Students also are tasked with raising $250 of their own each year. Students in their school's foundation are tasked with divvying up the money as they choose. The students receive rolling grant applications from their peers and from staff and determine which projects to fund and for how much. They will be reviewing applications throughout the year and giving that money away, Unmacht said. They really have to be thinking about, we can't spend it all in the first 2 weeks. We're going to have to make sure that we hold on to some of it for a while. Hempstead students gave out their first grant this month, awarding around $500 to their school's theater department for organizational items. Senior Samantha Fish, a member of her school's foundation, said she thinks the funds will make an impact. It's just really cool to be able to firsthand see where the money is going and how it's actually truly making a difference, she said. Madison said she appreciates that the group lets students decide what areas of their school most need funding, noting that she and her peers bring a different perspective than staff, for instance. The experience also helped broaden her perspective and provide her with an understanding of different groups at her school and the needs that they have. I think I've gained a little bit more empathy, too, because in order to be part of this foundation, you have to have an open mind and you need to be empathetic toward these different groups, Madison said. Molly Anderson, who teaches at Senior and is advising her school's Student Support Foundation, said students seem to appreciate being empowered to make a difference on campus. They're wanting to help their peers and wanting to help their school, but often they're not given a sum of money and told to really reach out and do things with that, she said. I think it's pretty amazing for them to be able to have that power. The organization also allows students to have conversations about different ways that they can make an impact, Anderson said. Those opportunities also hopefully will spark an interest in students to give back to their communities in the future. Whether that's time, talent, treasure, however they're deciding to give that, they'll maybe have gotten some of those skills to be able to decide how to pick where you want to spend your money, what's going to utilize that money best, she said. And now our third piece dominates the whole center of the front page, and yes, it is about this pandemic that has been going on for so long. And we have a large picture of an elderly lady dressed in a colorful red, black, gray sweater. And she's peering into a window. And the caption reads, Karen Osser visits with her husband Richard through a window at Mill Valley Care Center in Bellevue, Iowa on Wednesday. And our article's title, Virus Adds Challenge for Caregiver. from Bellevue. When Karen Osser phones her husband, Richard, sometimes he forgets to end the video call. He doesn't always know how to operate his GrandPad, a tablet designed for seniors, and Karen can hear him tuning into the television off-screen. She has to call a nurse's aide to turn the device off. Aside from an occasional car ride to visit the doctor, Karen has not touched her husband of 58 years since March, when his Bellevue nursing home closed its doors to visitors. The measures are designed for Richard's protection as the residents shelter as the COVID-19 pandemic rages outside. He knows there is something going on out there, said Karen, 78. He knows it's a bad disease, and he is okay with it. Richard, 81, checked into Mill Valley Care Center in 2018. Karen lacked the strength to continue as his full-time caregiver, a task she had embraced for the previous three decades. When you marry somebody, you do it for better or worse, she said. We had almost 25 good years before this. When he was 48 years old, a blood vessel in the back of Richard's brain burst. Over the ensuing decades, he developed vascular dementia, a condition that can impair reasoning, judgment, and memory. Often while driving, Richard became lost and called Karen, unable to describe his location except that houses were nearby. His ability to communicate was deteriorating. He used to come up and say, "Let's go climb a tree," Karen said. He hears in his brain, "I want to go for a car ride," but what comes out of his mouth is totally different than what he is thinking. Once Richard lost the ability to walk, Karen knew it was time to check him into a nursing home. He weighed 280 pounds and was losing his balance. People with Alzheimer's and other dementias face a new challenge with the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Alarmingly, the number of deaths attributable to the conditions in Iowa has increased nearly 14% in recent months, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That equates to an additional 304 deaths in Iowa and more than 31,000 annually. It's shocking to see the numbers, said Megan Pedersen, program specialist with the Iowa chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, a health organization that supports care, support, and research related to the disorder. While Alzheimer's and dementia do not in themselves increase the lethality of COVID-19, the associated conditions of those living with the diseases increase their risk. Patients with dementia often live in nursing homes and experience the loss of communication and cognitive abilities, increasing their chances of contracting the novel coronavirus, which causes COVID-19. About 50% of COVID-19 deaths in Iowa have occurred in long-term care facilities, where the communal living environment can facilitate the rapid spread of the virus among a high-risk population. It can be difficult to help someone with dementia understand the importance of protective measures such as social distancing, hand washing, and wearing masks, Pedersen said. Karen does not fear that Richard will catch COVID-19, as the care he has received at Mill Valley has been stellar. The facility only has experienced 3 confirmed infections in residents and no deaths due to COVID-19, according to the latest federal data. But the separation necessary to ensure his safety pains her. More than 136,000 people in Iowa care for a person living with Alzheimer's disease. Persisting through the pandemic has been particularly grueling. Before, they might have had the individual they were caring for go to group activities or adult daycare, Pedersen said. But with the closure of those services, social isolation and quarantine has accelerated the cognitive decline of their charges and puts their caregivers at risk of burnout. Before the pandemic hit, Karen spent 4 to 5 hours every day at Mill Valley playing cards and dominoes with Richard. He never partook in the games before he became ill, but started to just for her. Even while caring for her husband, Karen bustled through her days, volunteering at St. John's Lutheran Church at Bellevue Area Chamber of Commerce and in the assisted living section at Mill Valley. Now, her days are often spent inside her Bellevue home, sheltering from the virus, which escalated in Jackson County in October and has infected more than 1,200 people. "It's gone up hog wild," she said. Karen has adjusted her schedule, starting the day with Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, a Western television drama from the 1990s. From 9 a.m. to noon, she works the telephone for Northeast Iowa Area Agency on Aging, a nonprofit corporation that coordinates services for seniors. Karen checks in on about 35 people and delivers meals to their homes each week, one of the few times she leaves her own. Karen used to enjoy running her kitchen, the oven warm from the goodies she baked, but there's no sense in cooking for one anymore. She and Richard speak on the telephone two or three times every day. When Karen visits the nursing home, they talk through a window. Karen stands on the sidewalk, and Richard sits in a warm sunroom, each pressing their hands to the glass. "They end their conversations with an 'I love you,'" Karen says. Richard says it back. Then she walks away. "I go back to the car and just cry," Karen said. So she counts her blessings and prays to God for strength, because he is the one who can give it to me. We continue now with news from Dubuque and the tri-states, and topping the fold, we have our coronavirus updates. Area records four more deaths linked to virus. There were four more COVID-19-related deaths in the tri-state area as of Wednesday evening. Dubuque County reported two additional related deaths. Jackson County added one more, and Grant County, Wisconsin had one more COVID-related death. Dubuque County had 192 additional cases of COVID-19 between 5 p.m. Tuesday and 5 p.m. Wednesday. The county's 14-day positivity rate was 23.9%. The county's death toll moved to 86. By subtracting the number of related deaths and recovered in the county from the number of confirmed cases, there were 3,196 active cases as of 5 p.m. Wednesday, an increase of 106 cases from the previous 24-hour period. Jones County reported 62 additional deaths. The county's caseload count had jumped in conjunction with an outbreak at Anamosa State Penitentiary. The Department of Corrections reported 273 active inmate cases as well as two inmate deaths, and 47 active cases among staff members as of late Wednesday. Jones County's 14-day positivity rate fell to 38.7%. Jackson County reported 33 new cases in addition to the death and has a 14-day positivity rate of 28.6%. Delaware County reported 41 new cases and a 14-day positivity rate of 25.2%. Clayton County reported 35 additional cases with a 14-day positivity rate of 25.4%. As of Tuesday afternoon, the most recent data from the Iowa Department of Public Health, 51 Dubuque County residents were hospitalized due to COVID-19. Other counties had Jones, 31, Clayton, 17, Jackson, 16, and Delaware County, 8. The state continues to report on 9 area long-term care facility outbreaks. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, there were no changes in caseload, which stood at Luther Manor Communities, Dubuque, 76 cases, 25 recovered. Manor Care Health Services of Dubuque, 12 cases, 5 recovered. Shady Rest Care Center, Cascade, 7 cases, 2 recovered. Dubuque Specialty Care, 6 cases, 2 recovered. Good Neighbor Home, Manchester, 81 cases, 65 recovered. Edgewood Convalescent Home, 7 cases, 3 recovered. Anamosa Care Center, 38 cases, none recovered. Monticello Nursing and Rehab Center, 6 cases, and none recovered. And Alcater Care Center, 5 cases, and 1 recovered. Iowa's statewide confirmed case load rose by 4,166 to reach a total of 195,581. The state's related death toll rose by 39 new deaths to reach 2,067. In Wisconsin, Grant County added 53 cases Wednesday. Iowa County reported 45 additional cases. Crawford County added 15 new cases and Lafayette County 13. Statewide, Wisconsin reported an increase of 7,989 new cases Wednesday, pushing the total to 331,837. There were 52 additional related deaths reported, so the state count moved to 2,793. In Illinois, Joe Davies County added 12 new cases. The statewide total for Illinois grew by 8,922 new cases Wednesday, along with 140 additional deaths. That pushed the state's total to 606,771 cases and 11,014 deaths. My dear readers, listeners, this is not going away anytime soon. So please, if you have to go out, mask up, use sanitizer, wash your hands a lot. Please stay safe. Our center article from Dubuque and the Tri-States, we have a picture. Interesting is a young man dressed in a sport coat. Looks like a flag. He's got the stars and the stripes. And there are a number of people with red and on, and you can see a red, white, and blue flag. And the caption reads, Brent Thier of Dyersville, Iowa, performed the national anthem in front of a crowd of about 6,000 during a November 1st rally that included President Donald Trump at Dubuque Regional Airport. And the article's title, A Once-in-a-Lifetime Experience. When Brent Thier grabbed the microphone, he scanned the crowd and looked at the thousands of faces before him. He could feel the energy flowing from each person and tried to take it in and use it to steady his nerves. He closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and started to sing. "I was a little nervous, but I was feeling pretty confident," he said recently. "It was definitely an incredible experience. It was a once-in-a-lifetime experience." Thier, 21, of Dyersville, performed the national anthem in front of a crowd of about 6,000 people during President Donald Trump's November 1st campaign stop at Dubuque Regional Airport. But Thier's singing career started long before then. When he was just about 4 years old, he would sing for veterans at parades. At 7, he entered into a karaoke competition at the Dubuque County Fair, where he performed God Bless America, and came in third place, recalled his mother, Krista. From there, Thier went on to perform during 4th of July celebrations in Dyersville, as well as a basketball tournament at Clark University. In high school, he joined the choir at Beckman Catholic High School and even had a lead role during a school play, Krista said. Whoever wanted him to sing, he would sing for, she said. He would show up because he loved doing it. Recently, when Thier learned that Iowa Senator Kerry Colker, Republican Dyersville, had recommended that he sing during the Trump rally, he was thrilled. "I was excited," he said. "I said, absolutely, sign me up." "There was a competition, too," they said. "We will see how everyone compares." Colker said she has known Thier since he was young, and he would knock on doors for political campaigns and attend her political events. In fact, she recalled, this was not the first time that he had performed at a high school, high-profile event for someone in the presidential race. He performed 8 years ago in Dubuque at an event for Mitt Romney, then the GOP nominee. "He's been active in politics since he was 4 or 5 years old," she said. "His recent performance showcased his passion for the country." During the event, Thier was able to sit by Colker and speak with other Iowa politicians, he said. "It was just awesome," he said. "I've gone to Trump rallies before. This was by far the best one. There was a lot of love. There were a lot of people helping others. It was an incredible experience." Thier said his mom, aunt, grandma, cousins, and a few friends attended to watch him perform. "I am very thankful that Senator for putting in a good word for me," he said. "There was big applause at the end. They started chanting and screaming. I knew I did well then. Now we turn to our opinion page, and today we have an other view. This is by Kurt Ulrich, a frequent contributor. He's a freelance writer, a frequent contributor to the TH. He lives in Jackson County, Iowa. And we have as the article, "The Buck Stopped Here, Perhaps Waiting for Godot." That's a play that was written some time ago. Rural America. Last week, I was looking out my window toward the cold northwest, listening to a stiff breeze through bare trees, when a stag stepped silently into my side yard, collapsed his legs in the inelegant way all quadrupeds do, softly hitting the turf, and rested for an hour. His presence was quite calming, a warm ship floating on a sea of grass. Every few moments, I went to the window to see if he was still there, and before he moved on, I captured a photo of him. I hope he'll be around until next year, but it's unlikely. And that photo is at the bottom of the piece, and it shows the stag just calmly sitting in the sun and shade, his head turned to the left away from the camera, and his antlers are just proudly up in the air, and way in the background are the woods and the trees. Out here, the deer season is called the rutting season, or the rut, meaning that testosterone-laden male deer stags are actively stalking female deer does to ensure there will be baby fawns next spring, and while the urge to compare male deer to men is inviting, I'll refrain. Dozens race across the field in front of my house every day, deer, not men, and I yell at the does, "Faster, faster!" And if that's not traumatic enough for these gorgeous creatures, this is deer hunting season. First arrows, then gunshots. Speaking of guns, gun sales are expected to explode with the election of a Democrat to the presidency, particularly in the sales of semi-automatic rifles. Does this make any sense to anyone? You gonna hunt deer with a semi-automatic? No, it's a gun for killing human beings. I do admit, however, that I've been eyeing a rifle still being manufactured by the Henry Rifle Company in Wisconsin, a single-shot, long-range rifle. Not sure why. Maybe it's because I'm troubled that I'm one of the few unarmed people out here. COVID-19 numbers continue to surge in rural America, so I refuse to go to town for a haircut until a bona fide vaccine is available to me. So after 9 months without a haircut, I wish I could tell you that the hair on my shoulders makes me look like Death Eater Lucius Malfoy in the Harry Potter movies, but alas, I cannot. Instead, I look very much like Hogwarts caretaker Argus Filch. Remember him? He was the spooky old guy at Hogwarts who was mostly bald, and the hair he did sport was long. And like me, his constant companion was a cat. His cat was named Mrs. Norris. My companion is named Luna. Or perhaps you're familiar with the characters in Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Give me a dirty bowler hat and a ragged old suit, and I'm one of those characters. Old guys living difficult lives, believing with all their hearts that everything will become clear and that their lives will improve when a guy named Godot arrives. The dialogue is circular, folding back to existential discussions about despair and our own inability, especially these days, to move forward in any meaningful fashion. At one point in the play, one character says to another, "Well, shall we go?" The response was, "Yes, let's go." Neither makes a move. Like so much in today's world, it's all talk. We freeze up, afraid to be who we are, afraid to take the next step, afraid that no one will remember us, that our existence has been meaningless. Godot never arrives, and still we wait. We shouldn't. We should move on. We do have one letter to the editor on our opinion page. Republicans silent in times of crisis. from Corrine Murray, Carter Road, Dubuque. Sometimes courage skips a generation. This line from the book The Help seems fitting to describe our time. Consider the shameful silence of the majority, including our own U.S. senators, time after time. Silence, instead of offering appropriate words of congratulations to President-elect Biden. Silence, as the president refuses to cooperate in the transitional process with President-elect Biden. Silence, when children at the border were separated from their parents, some perhaps separated forever, and put into cages. Silence, when at the Supreme Court, the Trump administration argued to cut off health care from millions of citizens during a dangerous pandemic. Silence at the reality of nearly 240,000 deaths from COVID-19. Silence when the president, who never served in the military, called men and women in the armed forces losers. Silence when the Republican lieutenant governor of Texas offered $1 million to anyone who could confirm voter fraud. Silence when Republican lawyers filed baseless voter fraud cases in court. Silence when the Secretary of State in Georgia announced a hand recount instead of by machine for the sole purpose of slowing down the process. Silence about their decision to reject additional witnesses during the impeachment trial in the Senate and then voting to support the president because of a lack of evidence. Silence when President Trump's political rallies and White House gatherings turned into COVID-19 spreader events. Silence as the minimum wage remains at $7.25 an hour, unchanged since 2009. Silence as over 400 bills from the House gathered dust and died on Senate Majority Leader McConnell's desk. Facts are stubborn things. You are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald from Thursday, November 19th, 2020. It is brought to you by IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, supported in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. I'm Ken, your joyful reader. I rather enjoy doing this. I'm sitting in for another day on Thursday. Friday is my typical day. You'll hear me tomorrow again. But let us continue and with today's obituaries. Norma J. Weber, Bernard, Iowa. Norma J. Weber, 81 of Bernard, died peacefully at home November 16th. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, attendance at the visitation and funeral mass is limited to immediate family. A private family visitation will be held Friday, November 20th at Reif Funeral Home in Piasta. A private funeral mass will be held at Holy Family Catholic Church, New Mallory in Piasta on Saturday, November 21st, with Reverend Michael Schuler presiding. The service will be live streamed and viewable at 11 a.m. on the Reif Funeral Home Facebook page and may be viewed online following the service. Private burial will follow at Holy Family Catholic Cemetery, rural Piasta. Anyone unable to attend may send memorials to Reif Funeral Home. Attention, Norma Weber family, P.O. Box 1, Piasta, Iowa, 52068. A celebration of life service for Norma will be held at a later date. Norma was born October 20th, 1939, in Dubuque, Iowa, daughter of Joseph and Noreen Kelchin Turnus. She graduated from Piasta Independent High School as salutatorian of her class. On October 17th, 1962, she married Leo Weber, and the couple farmed in Bernard, where they proudly raised their 7 children. Norma had an outgoing personality that made her a friend to any stranger, and their house was a full, fun-filled meeting place for card parties and numerous family gatherings. Norma's infectious laugh, caring nature, and easy smile put people at ease, and she would lend a hand to anyone who needed it. Whether teaching religious education classes, volunteering in a classroom, chaperoning a bus trip, babysitting, or just mending a pair of jeans for someone, you could always count on Norma. Helping others was important to Norma. She held leadership roles in the Holy Family Altar and Rosary Society and was an active member of Catholic Daughters of America as well as her parish community. For many years, Norma lovingly provided childcare in her home. Although never trained as an educator, Norma always dreamed of being a teacher and proudly supported anything to do with education. In reality, Norma was a teacher of many things. She made sure her children had regular trips to the summer bookmobile, provided them with music instruments and lessons, and taught them to sew, cook, can, and plant a garden. Terrified of water because she couldn't swim, Norma spent hours in carpools to make sure all of her children learned this valuable skill. Leading by example, Norma instilled expectations of excellence, compassion, and a strong work ethic in her family. Norma enjoyed many hobbies, including square dancing with Leo, listening to polka music, and playing board games with her grandchildren. Never afraid to try new things, Norma loved travel, always excited to just ride along somewhere. Norma was also a terrific seamstress who stitched her love into quilts, curtains, prom, bridesmaid, square dance dresses, and clothes. She made flower arrangements for weddings, skillfully refinished furniture, and hand-embroidered dozens of flower sacks into towels for her children and grandchildren. Her bountiful guppy tank also was a source of pride. Of note, Norma's green thumb could rehab any plant, and she was especially passionate about her flower beds and gardening. Norma also loved playing euchre, and she made sure that anyone, well, everyone, who crossed her path learned to play. More than anything else, Norma treasured spending time with her family, and her love for life was infectious. She was immensely proud of her kids and grandkids, and she enjoyed watching them at sporting and music events. Recently, Norma proudly learned to navigate her iPad and looked forward to weekly Zoom calls with her family. Always filled with a youthful spirit, Norma would share stories, muse about life, and fill the hearts of all who gathered with words of wisdom. She will be deeply missed by her family, friends, and all who knew her. Dorothy A. Small, East Dubuque. Dorothy Ann Sevender Small was born September 22, 1929, passed peacefully at her daughter's home on November 7th. Dorothy is survived by her three children. As a dedicated mother and wife, she cared for her family above all else. Dorothy spent most of her life in Waukegan, Illinois, where she went to school, married and raised her family before retiring to East Dubuque to be closer to her favorite place, the Mississippi River. Some of her and Jean's happiest memories were made on their houseboat, floating along the river with good food and good company, and in their motorhome traveling around the country. A Chicago Bears superfan, tough euchre player, and perpetual bargain hunter, Dorothy will be sorely missed by many close friends and family. Pamela Schumacher, Galena. Pamela Pam Schumacher, 67, of Galena, died Tuesday, November 17th at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. A private family service will take place at Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena. Burial will be in Greenwood Cemetery in Galena. Charles J. Lee. Charles John Chuck Lee, 80, of Dubuque, passed away Friday, November 13th, Prairie Ridge of Galena. A celebration of life will be held at a later date and will be announced. Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is entrusted with arrangements. Condolences and memories may be shared at www.eaglehoffsiegertcasper.com. Charles was born April 26, 1940, in Iowa City, the son of Charles Henry and Genevieve Ney Lee. He married Virginia Burns on September 22, 1962, at First Presbyterian Church in Dubuque. She preceded him in death on March 13, 2000. Later in life, he married Jill Shanahan, and she preceded him in death on October 12, 2019. He served his country with the U.S. Army. Chuck was employed at John Deere Dubuque Works for many years. He was a man of deep faith, and he served as a deacon and elder, on church session at First Presbyterian for many years. Chuck had a friendly personality and was known to make friends wherever he went. He was an avid fan of the Cubs and the Bears and loved John Wayne and Abbott and Costello. His sweet tooth was legendary, and he had a nickname for everyone. Chuck was a loving father who was always there for his kids and enjoyed spoiling them. He was a bus driver for East Dubuque, which his kids thought was pretty great. Later, he enjoyed being a grandpa, and he had a special love for babies. He loved music, and he would sing old songs and have a dance to go along with it. He always made people smile and laugh, especially his grandkids. Barbara Zubler. Barbara Zubler, 72, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, November 17th. Visitation will be from 9 to 10:15 a.m. Wednesday, November 25th at Church of the Resurrection, where there will be a Mass of Christian burial at 10:30. Burial will be at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Key West. Miller Funeral Home of East Dubuque, Illinois, is assisting the family. Glenn W. Ketz. Glenn W. Ketz, 90, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, November 18th. Services are pending with Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home of Peter D. Butler, Sr. Peter D. Butler, Sr., 86, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, November 4th at Luther Manor from COVID-19. Due to the pandemic, private graveside services were held at Linwood Cemetery with the American Legion providing full military rites. Peter was born February 25, 1934, in Dubuque, son of Ellis and Barbara White Cottingham Butler. He graduated from Dubuque Senior High School and attended Southern Methodist University, where he was on their NCAA championship golf team. He served in the U.S. Army from 1956 to 1958. While stationed in Germany, Peter won the Berlin Open golf tournament. Back home, Peter's love of golf continued throughout his life, winning many tournaments, including DGCC Men's Golf Championships. Peter loved to travel, particularly enjoying train travel out west with Mary, Peter, and Paul. He almost always took his golf clubs along to play the many renowned golf courses across our country. One of his favorites was at Spring Green, Wisconsin. His love of golf eventually drew him to Pebble Beach, California, where he lived for many years, overlooking his beloved golf course next to Carmel Bay. Mary often joined Peter on the golf course by putting when they reached each green. Peter had a passion for all things golf. He married Mary Rosalie Flukiger on November 14, 1959, in Dubuque. They had two children, Peter Butler II and Paul Butler. Peter was very proud of his family and loved spending time with Mary, their kids, and grandkids. They were a big part of his life. Peter began his insurance career at Cottingham and Butler, joining his father Ellis and brother John. He later founded Butler Services Company, specializing in the growing niche of poultry insurance. Peter helped support many local organizations, including Findlay Hospital, the University of Dubuque, and United Way. While at Luther Manor, it gave Peter such great pleasure to bring happiness to his fellow residents, especially his lifelong friend, Jean Gordon. His smile and warm personality lit up a room. Janet Moser, Guttenberg. Janet Moser, 89, of Guttenberg, died on Tuesday, November 17th. There will be a private family service and internment. Tucky Allen Funeral Home of Guttenberg is assisting the family. James H. Scholes. James H. Scholes, 81, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, November 17th at Luther Manor. Private family services will be at a later date. Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home is assisting the family. John V. Meehan. John V. Meehan, 84, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, November 17th. A celebration of John's life will take place at a later date in 2021. Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home of Dubuque is assisting the family. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we have sad times and we lose many friends, but we can never forget. We always seem to have new arrivals. And today we have a nice long list of births. Starting with Wednesday, November 11th, Dirks, Melanie and Rebecca Dirks of Dubuque, a boy at Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital, Dubuque. Friday, November 13th, Dunwoody Delgado, Cyan Dunwoody and Samantha Delgado of Dubuque, a boy at Findlay. Lair, Justin and Roseanne Lair of Epworth, a girl at Findlay. Noack, Mark and Abigail Noack of Guttenberg, a boy at Findlay. Sunday, November 15th, Walls Skipper, Calvin Walls and Micaiah Skipper of Dubuque, a boy at Findlay. Monday, November 16th, Sharkey, Thomas and Alessandra Sharkey of Dubuque, a girl at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. Langmeyer, Joseph and Katie Langmeyer of Dubuque, or rather of Cuba City, a girl at Mercy. Tuesday, November 17th, Montgomery, Matt and Jessica Montgomery of Galena, a boy at Mercy. Wednesday, November 18th, Kimber, Zachary and Patricia Kimber of Dyersville, Iowa, a boy at Mercy One. We welcome all of you little ones. Welcome to some strange times. We wish you the very, very best. We now continue with some more news from Dubuque and the Tri-States, and one of our Tri-State pieces comes to us from Lancaster. Lancaster officials end up rejecting wheel tax. A split Lancaster Common Council has nixed the implementation of a motor vehicle registration tax, fearing that an additional city fee will foster negative sentiment among city residents, despite having one of the lowest tax rates in Grant County. Council members voted 4-4 against instituting the $20 annual per vehicle charge, leaving Mayor David Varnum to break the tie in opposition to the proposal. "I think the $20 is not really the point. It's what it represents," he said. "It's a straight tax on residents, not necessarily the people using the roads. There are people who can move just outside the city and still use our services like water and sewer." The city considered the tax as a means to raise additional revenue to finance road projects in the proposed 2021 budget, which the council unanimously approved this week. On average, the city budgets about $130,000 for street paving, but the 2021 budget only includes $52,000. City Administrator David Carlson recommended implementing a wheel tax, which at $20 per vehicle would generate more than $74,000 per year for road projects. "Our transportation needs need a long-term fix," Carlson said. "We have insufficient revenue to pay for expenses. I believe we should make that hard decision and have a long-term solution." Council President Shane Labuda and Council Members Stuart Harper, Joel Ingebrigtsen, and Katie Reuter supported the measure. Labuda said the tax restrictions that the state imposes on municipalities limits their ability to generate needed revenue. "That is a problem," he said, "not the cities resorting to wheel taxes. Let this serve as an impetus to seek change at the state level," Labuda said. Council members Mac Pennekamp, Rose Olivito, Robert Schmidt, and Brent Rollins voted against the tax. "The city funds most of its capital projects through the borrowing, but it has reached 82% of its borrowing capacity. In the absence of major projects, the 2021 budget contained no frills," said City Clerk and Treasurer David Kurahara. "I suppose if we were going through the Starbucks of budgets, this would be the skinny latte with no whip," he said. Continuing now, we have a number of pieces of news in brief scattered through a few pages here. At the top of those, we have Dubuque schools suspend elementary, middle school extracurricular activities. Dubuque school officials are suspending elementary and middle school extracurricular activities in response to new state COVID-19 mitigation measures. Joe Maloney, Director of Activities and Athletics for Dubuque Community Schools, said officials made the decision to be consistent across the board following Governor Kim Reynolds' latest round of COVID-19 restrictions. Her proclamation suspends sporting and recreational gatherings other than those at the high school, collegiate, or professional level, among other things. We're just suspending activities at this point in time and seeing where things go with the latest proclamation, Maloney said. High school students still can participate in extracurricular activities. Holy Family Catholic School officials similarly announced that they were suspending elementary and middle school activities that are held outside of the school day until December 10th. Dubuque man accused of sexually abusing teen girl. A Dubuque man is accused of repeatedly sexually abusing a teenage girl. Brian M. Tract, 21, of 675 West 11th Street, was arrested at 6.05 a.m. Wednesday on a warrant charging three counts of third-degree sexual abuse. Court documents state that Tract sexually abused a girl younger than 16 on three separate occasions. Investigators reported that he came to the Dubuque Law Enforcement Center and reported that he had sexually abused the girl. Three-vehicle crash injures three. Three people were injured Thursday night in a three-vehicle crash in Dubuque. Clint J. Hillary, 42, of Benton, Wisconsin, and his passengers, Shannon M. Hillary, 30, and Sadie L. Hillary, 17, all of Belmont, Wisconsin, were taken by ambulance to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center for treatment of their injuries, according to Dubuque Police. The crash occurred at about 6:30 p.m. at the intersection of the Northwest Arterial and Pennsylvania Avenue. Police said Michelle M. Schroeder, 52, of Hazel Green, Wisconsin, was driving north on the Northwest Arterial and attempting to turn west onto Pennsylvania when she failed to stop for a red light. Hillary's vehicle was traveling south on the arterial and struck Schroeder's vehicle. A southbound vehicle driven by Allison M. Schiewick, 30, of Dubuque, then struck Schroeder's vehicle. Schroeder was cited with failure to respond to a steady red light. We have one more piece of interest. Dubuque Bakery closes after petition from neighbors. Permit issues. We have a picture of the owner, Allie Fuller, talking with Bob Heath and his daughter, Grace, 6, both of Dubuque, at Milk House Artisan Eatery, Baked Goods and Catering in Dubuque on Wednesday. The article reads, a Dubuque business closed Wednesday after a dispute in the wake of a petition by neighbors and permit issues. Milk House Artisan Eatery, Baked Goods and Catering, 620 South Grandview, announced late Tuesday that its last day in business would be Wednesday. The business previously said it would operate through Sunday, November 22nd. The bakery and restaurant applied in October for a conditional use permit to create a seating area on the second floor of its building and create outdoor seating as a way to more fully develop the business as a restaurant. However, shortly before presenting the request to the city's Zoning Board of Adjustment, a petition was submitted signed by 22 residents opposing the application, arguing the expansion would create issues with parking, noise, and garbage. During the meeting, an attorney representing the petition signatories revealed that the Milk House property did not have a permit allowing it to operate as a restaurant in any capacity. The owners then announced that the business would close this month, prompting an outpouring of support. Thank you to all of our supporters for your words and actions of encouragement over the past few weeks. We were overwhelmed by it all, the business said in announcing its closure Wednesday. We explored all of the options and determined that we simply will not be able to sustain this business in our neighborhood right now. This brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. This is for Thursday, November 19th. Brought to you by IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, supported in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. And we urge you to listen to not just the readings of the newspapers across the state and here in the tri-states, but also to the so many other programs we have on IRIS. And if you have any comments or suggestions or criticisms or support, whatever it may be, please feel free to call us at the toll-free number 877-404-4747. And that brings us to the end of the Thursday edition. I'll be back with you again tomorrow. This is Ken reading today, and I'll be back tomorrow. Wishing you a safe day today. It's going to be a nice day out there for late in November. Might even get up to 60. So take care, mask up, maybe take in a little fresh air. Until tomorrow, be safe.